Medicaid has largely been a political issue in Arizona over the last few years. But new research brings it back to the medicine and the patients.
It's a crucial step in terms of Medicaid beneficiaries going on and getting the cancer screening.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the relationship between reimbursement rates and preventative care. Also, some of California's community colleges may start offering bachelor's degrees. Could Arizona's follow suit?
How well do our law enforcement agencies reflect the communities they serve?
And trying to make golf more popular by making it easier.
Some people say, well, let's put out a 15-inch cup. Well, to me, that's like taking a bunch of chess players and saying, we're going to play checkers now because it's faster and easier.
Plus, a changing of the guard, politically speaking, and a tiny desert concert goes psychedelic.
That and more coming up on the show after a check of this hour's news.
The city of Phoenix is going to try to reduce a shortfall of law enforcement officers by hiring at least 300 new police over the next 3 years. The initial additions will begin in March of next year. But how much will those officers have in common with the residents they serve, especially when it comes to race and ethnic background? Former Assistant Phoenix Police Chief Andy Anderson, now a law enforcement consultant, says departments across the country care about diversity.
It's been around for years. When I joined the police department back in the early 70s, there was a heavy focus on trying to recruit minority officers. I think, you know, we reinvent it a lot. We try to find new approaches.
So how difficult, how challenging is it in a place like this?
You know, I think it's challenging in most communities, and that's unfortunate. When I joined the police department, I was 23 years old, and I didn't really get any resistance from my family or my friends. My mother was a little apprehensive, but it was because of the perceived danger involved in it. It wasn't because I was joining the police department. That's not always the case in certain neighborhoods. I mean, there's a lot of these guys and women that grow up in neighborhoods that if they chose to apply to the police department, they'd lose friends. People would look at them differently. And that's unfortunate. That's tragic because everybody should be part of the policing process. You know, that's the only way that we can be effective and do it the right way is if we really are representative of the different neighborhoods and communities.
Andy, are there some best practices that seem like good ideas in trying to get more diversity on a force?
Well, you know what we had to do from, I think it was 04 to 07, I was overseeing the hiring. It was in my division. And I had to send teams back to the East Coast and the Midwest to recruit. That's how hard it was to. And we were hiring pretty fast. We were hiring back in that time. The economy was booming. It was going great guns, and everybody was hiring. And so we were really competing for quality people to join the force. And so we sent teams to universities, to job fairs in Chicago and back on the East Coast to encourage people to come out, and they did. And some agencies even gave bonuses, hiring bonuses. Back then, it was an unbelievable situation. I'd never seen anything like it, where it was so competitive to try to bring people into the department. And then, of course, all of a sudden, the economy crashed in about 09. I think the last time Phoenix had any significant hiring was in January of 09.
Andy, at its core is the issue of diversity. Is it an issue that is discussed behind the scenes? Is it something that comes up among the rank and file?
I think it's a very obvious thing that officers deal with. As a young officer, I spent time working in a predominantly black community, and life was easier when my partner was black. And it just breaks down barriers immediately. You're accepted immediately, and there's trust. And that's really what policing is all about, is trust. Once the barrier is broken and you start the conversation and you have the interaction, then you can build the trust. But you've got to get through that initial meeting. And that's when you really have the barriers and you have the problems sometimes, is when you first arrive on the scene. It can be very challenging to get people to listen and to talk. If you and I come from the same background, the same neighborhood, there just seems to be a trust there immediately. Even though we may disagree, at least we'll be more respectful about it.
Former Assistant Phoenix Police Chief Andy Anderson.
A quiet Scottsdale neighborhood has become the most recent location to deal with the growing issue of sober living homes. Resident Angela Ashley says she only learned about them when a neighbor decided to move.
Evidently, this lady who wanted to stay in the neighborhood had so much problems with the people in the sober home that she was frightened for her children and sold her house and moved away.
Sober living homes are places to live for people who are coming out of treatment centers. They're described as a way to extend a resident's recovery before fully reentering their previous environment, and the concept is relatively new.
Well, a couple years ago, if you had asked us what a sober living home was, we would have not been able to answer you because we didn't know that they existed.
David De La Torre is Chandler's principal planner. His city came up with regulations for sober living homes and other residential care homes. Among other provisions, they have to be separated by at least 1,200 feet and have to provide parking on site. The size of the house helps determine how many people can live there.
The goal of the regulations is not to prevent them from locating in the city, it's to integrate them successfully into the neighborhoods so the neighborhoods retain their residential character. And there's no negative impacts created on the neighboring properties.
In Scottsdale, Angela Ashley is hoping for a quarter-mile buffer, a little bigger than Chandler's. She also wants some sort of registration so neighbors know when a sober living home opens in their neighborhood, as well as rules on parking and the number of people living inside.
Nothing is stopping a regular person who doesn't have any experience in sober living to lease out the house to 9 more men. So I'm just asking the council to be proactive.
Ashley collected signatures from her neighbors on a petition and presented them to council members. But she also sat down with her neighbors, as well as Gonzalo Ardovan, who owns and operates Carla Vista Sober Living. It runs the home in Ashley's neighborhood.
When we were able to sit down with the neighborhood committee and really explain our program, how we operate, the type of folks we have, our background checks on all our individuals, our random drug testing, the comfort level came back. The support was there.
Ardovan says he supports rules and regulations as long as they're fair. Carla Vista runs 13 sober living homes in Arizona. He says they tend to have around 10 to 11 residents who stay an average of 6 to 9 months. And he says each city has handled regulating the homes differently.
It's been one of those situations that it's not clear. I think it's a big challenge for each city.
Do you find that the discussions in different cities and the issues that are raised in different cities tends to be different, or are they all basically dealing with the same set of issues and concerns?
I think they're similar. I think the primary issue is fear. It starts off with fear, and it's understandable. My opinion is it's just lack of education.
How important is it to your residents that they sort of are a part of the neighborhoods and the communities in which they live, as opposed to this place that's over there that, you know, people walking down the street maybe cross the street to avoid walking in front of the house?
I think it's imperative. It's dignity. It's many of these individuals, believe it or not, they're your coworkers. They're your family members. I myself am a recovering alcoholic and an addict. I've been there.
Ardovan says Carla Vista plans to open more sober living homes around the valley and out of state. In addition to its Arizona facilities, it also has homes in Colorado. He says he's worked with various valley cities on their ordinances and thinks regulations can raise the bar and set a standard for sober living homes. Scottsdale's Angela Ashley doesn't think she's asking a lot, and she doesn't want to stop sober living homes from opening in her city.
With my research, I realized that study has shown that sober homes do have a positive effect on these people that, you know, are going through, get them back into this society.
And even though Scottsdale doesn't currently regulate sober living homes, Ashley is hopeful that'll change. Still to come, some California community colleges may start offering bachelor's degrees. Will that reignite the discussion in Arizona?
Someone who is in a rural area, unless they're willing to up and move to Flagstaff, Phoenix, or Tucson, really do not have viable options for obtaining a baccalaureate degree.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's 2:15, and you're listening to the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. In Valley traffic at this hour, an accident on the 202 westbound at the 51 that's causing a bit of a backup. And also with the holiday weekend starting, we're bound to see that commute really getting heavy a lot earlier this afternoon. So I want to stay at work a little bit longer. I'm just kidding. For this weekend, sunny skies with high temperatures of 108 on Saturday, 107 on Sunday, and then for Labor Day, it should be sunny and dry with a high of 105. Currently, relative humidity is at 9%, sunny and 105 at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Friends of Animal Care and Control, providing spay and neuter vouchers to help reduce pet overpopulation. Help eliminate euthanasia at Valley Shelters by donating to this program at SaveShelterPets.org.
Monday is Labor Day. For some, Saturday will mark the beginning of a three-day weekend. For others, Monday is just another workday. But Labor Day was nationally recognized in 1894 as a holiday to commemorate the contribution that America's workers make to the nation.
Though the holiday is usually associated with the last day of summer and leisure, its roots are anything but peaceful. It was signed into law just 6 days after the violent end of the American Railroad Union's Pullman strike. While today in Arizona, labor union participation is one of the lowest in the country, sitting at just 6% in 2013, the state was on the cutting edge of labor politics in its infancy.
I think that Arizona makes a fascinating example of how much politics can change in a relatively short period of time in a place. A lot of people don't realize that Arizona actually had some of the most radical labor politics in the United States in the early 20th century, and that much of the structure of the Arizona state government and constitution was the product of labor organizing. When the Arizona State Constitutional Convention was convened in 1910, a very large percentage of the delegates were labor union members or activists, some of whom were actually very far left-wing.
That's Arizona native Catherine Benton Cohen. She's a history professor at Georgetown. She says during the early 1900s, copper miners rapidly organized into a variety of unions, some that were very radical and interested in not just protecting the workers, but in challenging the wage labor system and renegotiating the way the corporations and employees related to one another. During the time, it was a formal practice to pay Mexican workers less than American or white workers. The next generation of unions challenged that discrimination, and their success gave birth to the next wave of union members.
What you see, which is really essential to the history of Arizona politics, is the rise of a generation of Mexican-American unionized miners, and their children are disproportionately represented among the Chicano generation, the Mexican-American activists of the late 1960s and late 1970s, who organized across the country, but in college campuses like ASU and U of A and NAU, and they include people like Congressman Ed Pastor, whose father was a miner. They gave birth to a really important generation of political leaders in Arizona.
I'm going to be the congressman that fights for the downtrodden. I'm going to be the congressman that fights for that little kid who one day wants to go to Harvard or wants to go to ASU. And I'm going to say to that kid, you have that opportunity. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure you get it.
That's Ruben Gallego, considered part of a new generation of Latino leaders in the state. He won the Democratic primary this week in the 7th Congressional District. Consultant Jaime Molera of the Molera Alvarez Group says elected officials like Ed Pastor, Mary Rose Wilcox, and Alfredo Gutierrez paved the way for Gallego at a difficult time.
That generation of Latino leaders in the 50s, 60s, 70s, I mean, think about it, they were fighting for just basic access of voting rights, of fair treatment in the workplace. My generation grew up more about trying to have opportunities in education and in business.
There's been a discussion about how the Gallego campaign was more up on technology, the way they went about recruiting voters, et cetera. But in a more general sense, does this indicate a huge generational shift to you?
Well, it certainly shows that Ruben Gallego is very good about targeting millennials. That's a big shift because we've seen that right now there are over 50% of the eligible Latino voters are between 35 and 18. I mean, that's a huge block. And Ruben's done a good job of using social media, of going after young voters. In a very similar way, it's almost akin to what Obama did to Hillary Clinton. When Clinton was seen as the big front runner early on, but Obama was able to mine that potential field of millennials.
I've only mentioned Democrats, and I don't mean to be just focused on that. Is there a concerted movement, you think, on the Republican side in Arizona to recruit mainstream Latinos to run for office?
No, there isn't. And I think I've been critical of the Republican Party before for not doing enough on that front. I'm of the opinion that both parties don't do a good job of reaching out to Latinos. Democrats take for granted. They just say, oh, they have a Latino name. Well, they must be a Democrat. And I've seen many situations and many campaigns that when they do take them for granted, and if the Republicans are very active in going after the Latino vote, they can be successful. But there has to be a dedication and there has to be a commitment to do it.
As ideas shift or as approaches are modified based on
whether it's attracting millennials or just there's a different political approach. Maybe people think it's more effective going forward. Is Ruben Gallego potentially going to face more pressure from folks in his highly Latino district if he decides to expand his footprint? Does Gallego have to step lightly, let's say, to make sure he doesn't leave some certain Latino interests behind as he's trying to make it an even bigger reach?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because any time you change how you outreach to folks or how you start to target people, they're always a risk. And sometimes it's easier to just do the status quo. It's easier to run campaigns the way everybody else has run them. But then again, if people were to do that, people that have changed the way campaigns are done would never have gotten elected. But I think what Ruben Gallego proved in that district, if you run it the old way and you follow last year's playbook, sometimes you're gonna be stuck in that mode and you're not going to be successful.
Jaime Molera of the Molera Alvarez Group. Earlier this week, the Arizona Supreme Court said it would hear Governor Jan Brewer's appeal of a lower court ruling, which allowed a group of GOP lawmakers to challenge her Medicaid expansion plan. And new research now suggests Medicaid patients are more likely to get screened for breast, cervical, and colorectal cancer in states that have higher Medicaid reimbursement rates for office visits.
The findings are published in Cancer, the Journal of the American Cancer Society. Michael Halpern is a health services researcher at the U of A College of Public Health and one of the authors.
In terms of most cancer screenings, the physician, especially primary care physicians, generally serve as a gatekeeper, that the primary care physicians will refer patients for cancer screenings, such as mammography or colonoscopy or pap tests, so that it's a crucial step in terms of Medicaid beneficiaries going on and getting the cancer screenings, is that they are able to see a primary care physician. And in many states, a large number of primary care physicians either don't see Medicaid patients or see only limited numbers of Medicaid patients, in large part because reimbursement for primary care visits tends to be very low.
So it's not so much that doctors who see Medicaid patients aren't doing these screenings, it's that patients on Medicaid aren't able to go see a primary care doctor, they're instead going to the ER or not going anywhere at all.
We think that's the case. We didn't actually look at that question, but you're right that if a Medicaid enrollee can't get into a primary care physician's office to get preventive care, to get maintenance for chronic diseases, when something happens, they'll go to the emergency department. And the emergency department is very good at treating acute problems, but they generally aren't involved in referring people for preventive care.
Did you find that even in states where the Medicaid payments weren't as high, perhaps, as other states, that for those Medicaid patients who did go to see primary care docs, that they were still given those screenings?
We didn't pull out information state by state. We didn't want to be pointing fingers and saying this state doesn't do as good a job as this other state. We were really just looking at the general trends to look at across all the states, how does reimbursement for office visits seem to link to being able to get cancer screening?
In many states, Medicaid has been expanded with the Affordable Care Act. Arizona is one of them. And I'm curious if your study looked at all at what impact potential uncertainty in that program's future might have had. For example, in Arizona, there's a lawsuit currently going through the courts that could potentially repeal it, or a future legislature and governor could potentially repeal the Medicaid expansion. Would that, in your mind, based on your research, then lower Arizona's rates of Medicaid recipients who are screened for these cancers?
We unfortunately weren't able to look at that in the study. That we used data from 2007, so that it was just before Medicaid expansion. If I had to speculate, I think what you're suggesting is right, that in states where there's more uncertainty about whether Medicaid benefits are going to continue, that physicians may be more reluctant to be part of the program, to see patients, and therefore refer them for screening. On the other hand, and I'll kind of play both sides, what we did also find, though, is that in states where Medicaid beneficiaries had to renew their eligibility for Medicaid more frequently. People are actually more likely to get many screening tests. And we thought that perhaps that was due to people knowing that they were only guaranteed of being in Medicaid for a few months, and that it made both the patients and the physicians more focused on making sure that preventive care needs were taken care of.
Michael Halpern is a health services researcher at the U of A College of Public Health. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
So, need a taxi?
Yeah, I need a taxi.
190 over there?
My name is Omar Bogar. I'm the general manager of the Mayflower Cab Company at the airport.
Your attention.
I've been working this airport for almost 10 years. The airport officials and the dispatching system and the drivers and the management, they all work for the betterment of the traveling public. That's what we all have in our mind. How do we make the traveling public easier for them to get from A to B? The dispatchers, the drivers, the whole network is functioning as a unified, cohesive system.
That's Omar Bogar at the taxi stand at Sky Harbor. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, just send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Coming up, continuing our We Are the Valley community series with a conversation with a member of the atheist community of Phoenix. This is the show.
If you're trying to get an early start on your long holiday weekend, just one Valley traffic problem to be aware of. It's on the 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at the 51. It'll be sunny for the rest of the day. Today, look for a high of 107. Clear skies tonight. Overnight lows in the low to mid 80s. Then a sunny weekend for Labor Day with a high of 108 tomorrow, 107 on Sunday, and 105 on Labor Day Monday. Right now in Phoenix, it's 105 degrees at KJZZ at 228.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering USDA prime steaks, chef-prepared salads, and a selection of craft beers for Labor Day weekend. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
And now it's time for the quiz show.
Leszek, the first question is for you. Actually, this is an archaeology question.
We brought back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quizmaster, who's won a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia hosted by our producer, Sarah Ventry. And this week, he's playing senior field correspondent, drumroll please, Stina Sieg.
Last week, we gave you a word puzzle to solve and randomly selected two correct entries. The question was, when can you add 2 to 11 and get 1 as the correct answer? Now, Steve, we have the answer in front of us. Did you know it ahead of time?
First time I've heard this, Mark. No, I did not know.
Okay. So the answer we were looking for was on a clock. But some of you also said a baker's dozen. And since that also fits the answer, we took those as correct responses as well. Our randomly selected winners this week are Clifton Gray and Scott Schoeneman. Leszek will play on behalf of Clifton. Stina will play on behalf of Scott. Whoever wins gets a special KJZZ item.
Leszek, the first question is for you. Actually, this is an archaeology question because you're an archaeologist. So hopefully everything goes well.
Okay.
Recently, it was announced that archaeologists unearthed the oldest metal object found to date. The artifact was found in the grave of a woman at the Tel Tzaf archaeological site in Israel and dates back to the late 6th or early 5th century BC. What is the object?
Oh.
Do you know?
I was about to say I've seen a picture of it, but I can't remember exactly what it is. So I'm hoping you're... Your multiple choice will prompt me on that.
Okay. Is it A, an iron projectile point, B, a copper awl, C, a bronze ceremonial sculpture, or D, a piece of copper armor?
I believe it's C, the bronze piece.
It is actually B, a copper awl.
Wow. Okay.
All right, Stina. Last week, the U.S. Copyright Office weighed in on a fight between Wikimedia and British photographer David Slater. What was the fight over? Is it A, whether Slater's child had to be credited with taking a photo of Old Faithful that he accidentally snapped while playing with his dad's camera? B, whether or not Slater owned the rights to photos he took in Yosemite National Park using a drone-based camera? C, whether or not selfies taken by a macaque after Slater dropped his camera belonged to him or not? And D, which state's tourism department owned the rights to a photo taken at Four Corners?
Okay, I'm in a monkey mood. I will say C, the macaques.
You are correct.
Yay! Correct,
yes.
It was a macaque selfie. I guess he dropped his camera and then
a McKelfie.
Exactly. It was a McKelfie. And it was a good one too. It's a great picture.
Yes, it's a magnificent selfie. It's just wonderful. Just a big, big, wonderful monkey grin right into the camera.
So Leszek, your next question. While screening a passenger at the Houston airport last week, U.S. Customs and Border Protection said they found about 7 ounces of cocaine stuffed in what? Is it A, brownies, B, a piñata, C, cans of baked beans, or D, tamales?
This is just going to be a complete out-and-out guess, and that's going to be D, tamales.
You are correct.
Whoa.
You sound so surprised. All right, it's 1-1. It's anybody's game.
Okay. I knew that one, too. Oh, okay.
All right, Stina, your next question. Have you ever wondered why hummingbirds love nectar so much? New research has an answer. Is it A, their taste receptors that were once used to detect savory evolved into ones that detected sweet? B, there's a chemical in the nectar that releases serotonin, making the birds feel generally safe and happy? C, because their wings flap so fast, they actually need the glucose boost in order to constantly move? Or D, because who doesn't love sweets?
I'm going to say it's the one about the flapping your wings a lot.
The glucose boost?
Yes.
You are wrong.
Ah!
Wow.
I know.
That would have been my guess.
It sounds so right.
From the mind of Sarah Ventry. It's actually that their taste receptors were once used to detect savory and over time evolved to detect sweet ones instead. All right, so Leszek, your next question. This one is an audio clue. Identify the singer in this new song called Shake It Off. It was performed at the MTV Video Music Awards on Sunday. Here it is. I stay out too late. Got nothing.
I'm embarrassed to say that I actually know this one. That's Taylor Swift.
It is Taylor Swift. Are you more a fan of her country stuff?
I'm not a big country fan, but what I've heard of her stuff, I've actually liked. Not sure I like the new direction.
Fair enough. I think a lot of people fall into that camp. All right, so Leszek has gotten 2 correct. Stina, you've gotten 1. You have to get this one in order to make it to the tiebreaker. Stina, identify this song, which won MTV's Video Music Award for Video of the Year on Sunday night. You ready?
No.
We clawed, we chained our hearts in vain. We jumped.
You know? Go
I
ahead.
Do. This is Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus.
It is.
Yeah.
It is Wrecking Ball. All right, you guys got Taylor Swift and Miley Cyrus. I think this is a first for the quiz show. We, for the first time ever, need to do a tiebreaker.
Oh, God.
So I will ask the question, and whoever knows the answer first, you should just say it, and then you will be the one to win, okay? Up to how many tons of water can the saguaro cactus store?
40.
That is incorrect. Leszek?
If you're looking for a guess from me, I'm going to say 2.
That's wrong, but Leszek is much closer. The answer is 9.
Ah.
So we have to give it to Leszek. So Leszek wins this week.
Yay!
But Stina, you
redemption,
fought the good
yay.
Fight.
No, you pushed me to the limit, Stina.
We'll keep bringing Leszek back every so often, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle and your chance to be one of our at-home players. California Governor Jerry Brown is considering a bill that would allow a pilot program for some community colleges there to offer bachelor's degrees. It would only apply to 15 of the state's more than 70 districts, and each would only be able to offer one degree program not offered at any of the state's public universities.
Suzanne Hultin studies community colleges and workforce development issues for the National Conference of State Legislatures. She says the idea of community colleges offering bachelor's degrees has picked up steam recently.
I think a lot of opponents argue that this is a mission creep of what community colleges are doing and what their purpose is. But I think on the other hand, community colleges would argue that one of their main missions is to help prepare the workforce of the future. And so they are just responding to workforce needs.
If this concept sounds familiar, it's probably because it's been debated in Arizona for nearly 20 years. Linda Thor is the chancellor of the Foothill De Anza Community College District in Northern California.
Before that, she spent nearly two decades as president of Rio Salado College, which is part of the Maricopa Community College District. She was involved in the discussions over getting the pilot program started in California and worked on the issue here as well. She says there are several reasons for community colleges to offer bachelor's degrees.
The needs in the workplace have changed, and more jobs that used to require an associate degree now require a baccalaureate degree. Community colleges are particularly expert at workforce preparation, and the baccalaureates that we're talking about offering are applied baccalaureates, are those that directly meet a workforce need. We need to provide more access to affordable, quality, accessible degrees.
How will you judge success at the end of this pilot when you try to convince lawmakers in California to expand this?
Well, first, we'll be able to offer a baccalaureate at a cost to students of approximately $10,500, which will be the most affordable baccalaureate in the state of California. Secondly, we'll be judged on the number of students who successfully complete the program in a timely fashion. And we'll also be judged on whether those students were successful in obtaining employment in the field for which we prepared them.
How would you compare the debates on this issue that you just went through in California and the ones that you went through over many, many years here in Arizona?
Our first attempt to obtain authority to offer the baccalaureate degree in Arizona began in 1996 and led to legislation in 1997. At that time, we were very much pioneers on this issue. There were probably only two or three states at that time that had given community colleges this authority. When we introduced it then, there was tremendous opposition from the public universities. But times have changed. We have much more awareness now of the need to increase the number of individuals who have baccalaureate degrees. Also, in the 18 years since we first worked on this, the cost of higher education to an individual has dramatically increased. But also, we've seen great success in the 22 other states. And we've seen them work their way through many of the issues that were raised back in 1996, 1997. So we're not dealing in the unknown anymore.
Do you think that was one of the big stumbling blocks back in the mid-90s here in Arizona, that there just weren't other states that lawmakers could look to and say, okay, that's how it works, that's how it might work here?
Well, I think the big issue back in the mid-90s for the universities was that they did not believe that a need existed. We, of course, felt differently about that. And I would argue even today that there's even more need for the community college baccalaureate in Arizona than there is in some other states. And that's because of the fact that the state only has the three public universities. So someone who is in a rural area, unless they're willing to up and move to Flagstaff, Phoenix, or Tucson, really do not have viable options for obtaining a baccalaureate degree.
Linda Thor is chancellor of the Foothill de Anza Community College District in Northern California. She also served as president of Rio Salado College. KJZZ, by the way, is licensed to the Maricopa Community College District. Reports from China say a giant panda may have faked her pregnancy to get extra buns. The animal had shown behavior associated with pregnancy, and a live broadcast of the birth had been planned, but sadly it was not to be. The BBC's Charlotte Gallagher sent this report.
The panda called Ai Hin had shown signs of pregnancy, including a reduced appetite and a surge in hormones at a breeding research centre in Sichuan province, but then her behaviour returned to normal. Panda mums-to-be get moved into air-conditioned rooms and are given treats such as fruit, buns and extra bamboo. One of the experts at the centre said the more intelligent bears had noticed this special treatment and used it to their advantage to improve the quality of their life. Pandas have a notoriously low birth rate, and only 24% of the females in captivity ever have cubs.
That's the BBC's Charlotte Gallagher. Pandas, by the way, apparently not just adorable, very, very bright.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. The show is a KJZZ original production blending news from our community with national and international stories. Quick check of Valley traffic, a couple of accidents to watch out for. One is on the 101 northbound at McKellips. That's blocking the right lane. Also the 202 westbound at the 51. Sunny skies and 105 degrees at 242. Earlier this week, we presented a roundtable conversation on religion on KJZZ's Here and Now. It's part of our continuing series on community called We Are the Valley. As an extension of that conversation, we wanted to recognize there is also a community of atheists and non-believers in the Phoenix area. Holly Schineller is an organizer in the Phoenix Atheist Meetup Group. I talked with her about how members of this community come together for social reasons, as well as for support in times of need, similar to the way a church community might be there for one of its members.
It's a pretty independent group. So, as you can imagine, a lot of them have come from religious backgrounds or backgrounds where they felt sort of under the thumb of something or under control of something or maybe restricted in their ideas or their the way that they live their lives. So most of them are pretty independent and not ready to look to necessarily follow anything. And it can be sometimes pretty divided in our community because of that, I think. Mm-hmm. The group I organize specifically, which I didn't start, is strictly a social group. And the Phoenix Atheist Meetup Group, as organizer, I try to keep it totally social because we do have other groups in the Valley that do other things. So we have a community in the Valley, but we don't come under all one umbrella very often.
There are some, and this has, I think, probably very little to do with a belief system, but there are some people who, even those who are into a more traditional religion, don't really like the restrictions that a religion places on them. Is that anything that you had blanched at in the past too, this feeling? And how does building an atheist community sort of fit into that?
It's a challenge because it's only one small slice of your life. And to even join any of the groups, it has to be an important slice of your life, but it's still only one very small part of it. So for me, for example, it fits with some of the things I do. Other times, it's a total non-issue. Non-belief doesn't have this umbrella that dictates the rest of your life.
Okay.
And so we don't all come together under some places where maybe a religious person might. So I have a lot of friends who are not active in the atheist community or non-belief at all because it's a non-issue. They just don't believe in God and they just go on with their lives.
So with the social gathering that you put together with the community, it's not one of those things that 20 of you are sitting around eating pizza and the only topic that comes up is that we don't believe in a God.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it usually only comes up if maybe something's in the news, it's election time. We likely have a new person in the group. And they have come to the group for a reason. They've come because they have no one else to talk to. They come because they've just left their faith, or maybe they just had a crisis of faith and they're looking to talk to somebody about it because they don't have anybody else. Or maybe they just got married and they married somebody who is religious and that's a mixed marriage. Or maybe they're just had a child and, oh, at opening day of Little League, the first time I have one son and our son was in Little League and we didn't remember this from when we were kids. We had no idea that the first thing you do in the Little League pledge is pledge to God. And when they're all doing it and there's hundreds, maybe 1,000 kids on the field and everybody's pledging to God, my husband and I are looking at each other going, we weren't prepared for this. What are we going to do about this? You know, and it kind of took us by surprise. But there's all of these things that are default to Christianity or default to religion in our culture.
Let's compare when you were in middle school and, okay, you're an out atheist at that point. Did people think that's a phase she's going through? She's headstrong. And how would you compare that to where your kids are at now? Do your kids feel confident in that position? How did you make them feel confident about being part of the broader community, knowing that, I mean, like with any of us, of course, some people are going to look at us as being different, and so that's uncomfortable. How do you help them get through that?
You know, I think my kids have a lot of challenges in other ways that I didn't, but I don't think they have the challenge of growing up without faith like I did. But as a middle schooler telling people I didn't believe in God, they automatically went to, well, you must worship the devil. And it was astonishingly hard to explain to these otherwise, you know, coming from well-educated families, it's part of the same story. I can't believe in the God and worship the devil. It doesn't work like that. I don't believe in any of those stories. I did have an experience in a church where a woman told me that my mom was already possessed by the devil and the devil was trying to get to me. So it was important that they come visit me. And that, I was pretty young at that point. And that kind of helped shape my idea of organized religion, along with some other experiences I had that kind of solidified my atheism. Mm. It's hard as a kid to have an adult tell you that your mom is possessed, and I don't know. So I think my kids have it easier.
Holly, whether it really manifests itself this way or not, as a community, as a society, we're all supposed to have these great shared moral values, shared ethical values. And I'm sure you've heard from people who say, well, if you don't believe in the Bible or the Old Testament or New Testament or whatever it is, and then there was a creator, where do your morals come from? Do you get that question and how do you answer it?
My brother asked me that. He said, where's your moral compass? And I was, you know, held onto the counter for a moment and said, are you kidding me, John? You know where my moral compass is. I'm raising 4 children. You see how I raise my children. You know, this, I don't know for sure what's going on in the mind and heart of a believer, but I suspect that we have the same things going on, this sort of innate human nature. I just don't give it a label and attribute it to the supernatural. So I think owning my ideas is very important. So I don't say they're God's ideas or some supernatural being or a spirit or anything like that. It's just mine.
Holly Schineller, who told us about the atheist community she belongs to in the Phoenix area. The conversation is part of our continuing series on community, We Are the Valley.
Tell us about your community, religious or otherwise, by sending us an email at wearethevalley@kjzz.org.
Less than a decade ago, golf's popularity had left stereotypes behind. Its country club reputation had morphed into something a lot more mainstream. But with Tiger Woods' fall from grace, the number of people playing the game dropped dramatically before leveling off recently. That's led to some of the industry's power brokers to push for changes, including making putting a lot easier by introducing 15-inch cups on the green. And a company called Topgolf is trying to make the game hipper for millennials by making it more party-centric. Ed Gowan is executive director of the Arizona Golf Association.
I think the game itself is intrinsically strong, and it will grow again once some of the issues that caused it to slow down are, let's say, absorbed.
What are some of the challenges right now? What are some of the issues you're talking about?
Well, let's go back historically to the early middle 90s with the so-called Tiger effect, when Tiger Woods started to win tournaments. He became a sports icon outside of the golf aficionados. And so people came to the game. Everybody jumped on the bandwagon, and the game exploded. Golf courses were being built. Golf became an experiential sport for a lot of people that would dabble in it previously, but now it became something that was mainstream. And what we're seeing now is the same thing that's happened with a lot of other sports. When the big growth and the push that created this media frenzy and Wall Street investments into new golf courses with the idea of you build it, they will come. When it starts to come back to the sport itself, it's a hard sport. And a lot of the courses that were built just simply don't match up with the attitude of young people now and older people. It's like the game has to find a way to fit into this new set of clothes and it needs some tailoring.
So what do you think of those 15-inch cups that could actually fit a basketball in? What do you think about those to make putting easier?
Well, to me, that's like taking a bunch of chess players and saying, we're going to play checkers now because it's faster and easier. And after a little amount of time, people might gravitate that way, but then they become disillusioned because the challenge that brought them to the table to begin with is no longer there. Top Golf, for instance, has had a great run around the country. That is very attractive to young people who want a little bit of a golf experience but are embedded in the game. Things like that will certainly help golf's image, but fundamentally changing the game itself is not the answer.
If young people like Top Golf, for example, can that be a transition or are the games so different?
Apples and oranges, but still it's golf, and that puts it in the view of the majority of the population, and so it will help. If you might remember 25, 30 years ago, putt-putt was everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And people came and there were putting contests and putting professionals, and that didn't replace the game. It was just another accommodation that put golf in people's mindset.
Ed Gowan is the executive director of the Arizona Golf Association.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by the Virginia G. Piper Cancer Center at Scottsdale Healthcare, where patients have access to a combination of cancer treatment and support, research, clinical trials, and academic medicine. shc.org/cancer.
KJZZ has been taking a listen to local bands across the valley for our Tiny Desert Concert Series. This week, we hear from Strange Lot, a three-piece psychedelic band with a hint of garage rock based in Phoenix. Strange Lot came into the KJZZ studios to chat with me a little bit about their music and play a few songs for us. We talked with bassist Dave Dennis, singer and guitarist Dominic Mena, and drummer Tim Lormore.
What we've found in Phoenix so far is there's so much variety of what's going on, and there's pockets of certain genres and scenes and stuff, but it's, I guess our idea is to kind of go past that and just, we just want to play the music we love to play, and if we fit in, we fit in. If not, then we'll see where else we can fit in.
You know, it's relatively early in the day, so I'm not asking for too much profundity at this point, but the psychedelic sound, could you define that? We're going to hear a little bit of it, of course, but based on just describing it, what does it sound like to you?
To me, psychedelic just means just taking left turns and or music that morphs, I guess. I guess I just see it as like not straightforward music, because it could be anything. Psychedelic could mean anything at this point in time with all the technology, and even electronic music can be psychedelic, but I think as long as it has that weird twist here and there, that's what makes it psychedelic.
There's some sort of like trance elements, not trance, but like you just kind of lose yourself in what's going on and then snap you back into reality all of a sudden.
All right, let's hear a tune.
Oh, when night falls.
I don't know. Well, I mean, the way I write lyrics is a very stream of consciousness, so I like things to come naturally. I don't like to force it or think about it too much. So I'll just, with that one, with every song, I just close my eyes and sing whatever images pop into my head, and it seems to have this overall mood / feeling. So with that one, I mean, the first lyrics are people run lost inside, so it's just like a proclamation of how everyone's just not really sure where they're going, but... Yeah.
Are your lyrics influenced by how you feel in a certain day? If you're feeling a little more up, do you feel like maybe that's not a day I should write lyrics? What influences you when you want to write lyrics?
I don't know. I mean, I take influence from everything, but I mean, that's the beauty of stream of consciousness, is that you don't know where it's coming from. Your mind and your subconscious takes over, and you allow it to speak whatever you're feeling. And yeah, it can be whatever I'm feeling that day, but I'm not consciously aware of it and forcing it out.
With a three-person band like this, can you guys cover all the sound spectrum you want to? Because it's been, there are different bands that have four and five guys, and you've got three. How does that work for you?
I think it works great, because Tim, I mean, to me, his style is also very tribal, because he puts together lines of drums. It's not just a standard kick, snare, ride. So I love that. But also, I mean, I use effects on guitar to fill out that sound. And I mean, you have the bass, and that's the low end, so that covers it. So I think... yeah, we have a very nice, well-rounded sound.
Yeah. That's what brings us to the same page, I think, is we all come from other acts and come from other things where, for whatever reason, it didn't seem to go somewhere, or it just, we lost interest in it. And I think this is something we all want this to go somewhere. I mean, for as short a time as we've been together, it was funny, the first practice we ever had, first time I had ever really met him, and we sat down and played the songs through. It was so...
Immediately clicked.
It was nice. It was very cool.
What's next song you play for us?
We'll do Walk of the Sun.
Yeah.
All you lay on my lawn, there I found you there smiling.
That Strange Lot playing their song Walk of the Sun. Earlier they played the song Fiction. Strange Lot will be playing tonight at the Yucca Tap Room in Tempe. To see a video of the band playing here at KJZZ, visit kjzz.org. And if you're in a local band and want to play a Tiny Desert concert, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Lots of good stuff going on this weekend for your holiday weekend. You might want to get it started tonight. You can see comedian Tim Meadows performing at Stand Up Live in downtown Phoenix. You might remember him from Saturday Night Live, also The Ladies' Man.
And tomorrow night at 8 at Jobbing.com Arena in Glendale, Mark Anthony without Cleopatra. He's the best-selling tropical salsa artist ever. He's also won 2 Grammys.
You can also see The Offspring tonight at Mesa Amphitheater, punk rock band of California skaters. You might remember them from the 90s.
And tomorrow from 10 until 3 at the Westin Kierland Resorts in the North Phoenix area, it's Phoenix Cooks.
The show was produced this week by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vianne, Kendra Sabo, and Caitlin Stein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias, and our executive producer is John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. If you have a long weekend plan, we hope you make it a good one. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.